All right, welcome to the Sports Medicine Broadcast. We are here talking with Kevin Maloney from Memorial Hermann. Morning, Kevin. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Tell me about where you work and what you do.
Yeah, I am currently a physical therapist at the Medical Center for Ironman Sports Medicine Institute. I also am an outreach physical therapist to the University of Houston Athletics, and I teach in the Master's Athletic Training Program at the University of Houston.
Cool. All right, so tell us what you talked about this morning.
Yeah, so my discussion was on the rehab toolbox. So the update on modalities, and I discussed the use of dry needling, cupping, and then Theragun, as well as blood flow restriction training, and how that can, what is the update on the evidence, how these modalities are applied, what is the theory behind them, and what is their physiology.
So just kind of give an overview. This is the new stuff coming out, right?
Yeah.
So it's not the old tried and true, you know, TENS and NMES and hot and cold,
yeah,
and ultrasound. So how far are we away from getting some more hardcore evidence on if things are working, or is it coming around pretty quick?
Well, that's a really tough question. And as we know, it depends on each different modality. There hasn't been a lot of research on cupping or Theragun percussion massage tools at this time. And so if you kind of take those into context and look at what the research could look like from a blood flow restriction training. Blood flow restriction training has been researched for some 60 years. And so with that, it finally has the backing that blood flow restriction training has worked. So I guess it might take 60 years before we actually know the true efficacy of how good needling and cupping and Theragun can work from an actual, like, United States Western medicine standpoint.
Okay.
So I'd say we're a little ways off for some of these modalities. And one of the big points I wanted to make is that in my talk is that these modalities that will always gain, like, popularity and widespread use, and scientific research will always be behind, so we're always going to have to catch up. So trying to stay up to date is important, but know that we're likely not going to have an answer for a while now.
Going back to the Olympics, when it seems like some of these modalities, it kind of reminds me, get popular through the mainstream, just like you mentioned.
Exactly.
So the Olympics, with whenever all the volleyball girls were wearing the kinetic, you know, the KT tape,
yep,
right?
And then you flash forward to
Michael Phelps with the cupping, right? Right. So let's kind of talk about cupping. You know, you mentioned not having a lot of validated research. Kind of tell me where it's being used, and then, you know, how it's being affected and how it's translating over.
Yeah. So I did mention the research earlier, and I did say that there is the possibility of different theories behind how it could work physiologically. Unfortunately, the physiological research hasn't been validated in a systematic review. But as I said, the one study that was done on using cupping has demonstrated, maybe for like chronic back pain patients, that it might be better than usual care. But that was only one study. So
yeah.
I think in terms of, like, knowing that in a college setting, when you're just trying to help the athlete with pain and just trying to look at the physiology behind, hey, if I can put this cup on a patient and it can cause increased microcirculation and it can try and kind of burst those capillaries, and that might theoretically decrease the pain pressure threshold, I'm going to do it. Knowing that I'm going to see, especially in the college setting, that I'm going to see this athlete multiple times throughout the day for, say, their early morning conditioning and then before practice and then again for their cool down, I got some time on my hands where I can stick a cup on them, let them sit for 10 minutes, and maybe have an improvement in their pain. So, yeah, I've utilized cupping anecdotally in the college setting, hoping that, hey, this might actually help this athlete throughout the day. And that's all sometimes we're trying to do with these athletes who are overworking, is we're just trying to get them through the day and push to the next.
So you kind of mentioned how it uses the gait theory for pain.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's other modalities that kind of use that same idea. Why would cupping be better than some of the other ones?
Yeah, exactly. So I think the non-invasive technique of it is pretty important. So not all patients respond to dry needling. And actually, that's one of the contraindications. If someone's afraid of needles,
Sure. Obviously
don't stick them with needles. Additionally, some patients might have had very poor experiences to pain. Because it is invasive, there are inherently more risks to it. So utilizing cupping is more of a superficial first line of defense modality and getting the athlete more comfortable with just pain treatment therapy, I definitely think it could be of use in that realm.
All right, so I'm going to put you on the spot. You're gonna write an infograph for a doctor and a trainer, okay?
Okay.
For the cupping.
Yeah.
What would you put on there for cupping, an infograph on, you know, why it's used, where it's used, and then who's best for it? Just real, you know.
Yeah, so I think I would create the same one, because I think athletic trainers and physicians should be able to speak the same language. So
right.
I think if I was to create an infographic, I would say at this point, and seeing that there's such limited research, I would say you can utilize this on anyone with myofascial pain or muscle tightness.
Yep.
I'd say you can go ahead and utilize it for 5 to 15 minutes, typically one time a week. I would more or less say that at this point, ideally, we're getting a gait control theory of pain, and that maybe a little bit of increase in those endogenous opioids and analgesic serotonin. So hopefully that helps with pain. I guess I would try and say something along those lines.
Yeah, perfect. Hey, I'll put you on the spot.
A lot of fun pictures with the actual blood flow because people love seeing that.
Yeah. So let's move on to dry needling. Yes. All right. So a physical therapist myself, I see it in the clinic. I don't do it, but I've got a couple therapists there who do. So we get a lot of referrals. So you mentioned it's not acupuncture.
Correct.
All right. So layman's terms, for people who are kind of being introduced to it, kind of give me the difference between what, you know, acupuncture and dry needling and kind of what we're shooting for.
The big difference that we've seen is actually the theory behind why it's utilized. So what we have seen in traditional Chinese medicine is the theory that you're trying to move a qi along a meridian to change a person's well-being. They actually have acupoints, which correlates to specific organs. So their gallbladder 21 point is located in actually a known trigger point for a muscle. Mm. And so it's not uncommon to actually needle the same locations as acupuncture, but the theory behind it is very differently. The Western medicine has looked into the physiology behind what happens with it, whereas traditional Chinese medicine has looked less at that and more of how the patient has a well-being of feeling, which I think is harder to quantify in terms of science. So I think that's why some of the acupuncture literature can be utilized for dry needling. However, not all of it, based off of how the outcome measures are actually assessed. So there's a little difference in the theory of how it works, but I'm going to say from an actual like standpoint of physiologically, more or less I'm doing a very, very similar construct to acupuncture.
Okay. You mentioned myofascial trigger points being utilized for that and having some good results with the research so far, right?
Yeah, they have. When you elicit that local twitch response, you can actually have a central mechanism of pain. You can actually have increased microcirculation and a decrease in like poor chemical mediators that are sitting around a muscle. But one of the big points that I made is that numerous studies have had a really hard time saying that palpation is an effective way to actually find a local trigger response.
Right.
There used to be like a theory that, hey, when you touch a hypermobile and spot and it's the tight band and it recreates the patient pain, those three things would help you identify that it's a trigger point. But unfortunately, that has not been validated in any of the research studies. They're like, oh, if it like refers pain to a certain pattern or if you get a local twitch response when you touch it, then you're very much on a trigger point. But none of that has actually kind of come to use in the actual research.
So anecdotally, you're kind of just using your experience, what you've seen, what's worked best to kind of find out how to use it?
Yeah, and then it depends on which organization you go through and how they teach it. So I know Kineticore, just from discussing with colleagues, that you are used to use your hands to find the trigger point. It's very different than the theory I was taught under the Spinal Manipulative Institute, which is when we actually have set points that are similar to the acupuncture literature that know, like, hey, this is the muscle belly for the infraspinatus where most trigger points have been found to be. So it has a little bit more of a protocol to it under the way that I learned it.
Yeah.
And that helps, I think, make it a little bit more easier to utilize in my clinic because we all speak a similar language in terms of, hey, we're going to go to this point and we're going to go to this point. So we all can kind of have a similar effect over time,
so
ideally.
Back in PT school, we had this big giant roadmap of a body for our NMES trigger points whenever they gave us that little wand and we touch that spot, right?
Yeah.
Are those motor unit trigger points going to be similar to some of these areas?
It's very similar to that map that you can probably Google and find the trigger points for the TFL. It's a very similar map with like a referred pain pattern that you're discussing.
So something you can find on Google.
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. Absolutely.
You mentioned tendinopathy.
Yes.
So give me that.
The goal with the needling for a tendinopathy is that when you go in with the needle, you can increase the vasodilation, which we know when a tendon has been inflamed for a prolonged period of time, it actually has a decrease in blood flow. So hopefully bringing new blood flow to the area can kind of re-spark a healing process. Causing a little trauma might actually help reset the healing. Additionally, especially when you get towards like the insertional tendinopathies, when you actually needle towards the enthesis, like into the bone, and actually do pony pecking, that's actually where the blood supply for the enthesis lives. So those insertional tendinopathies, you're actually trying to peck the bone a little bit because that's actually where that periosteal blood supply actually helps to supply blood to where the tendon actually inserts.
Similar to like a microfracture where you're just trying to get blood to come out.
You're just trying to get blood. So I mean, we're just pecking the bone. We're not drilling into it. But kind of a similar idea is that if that's where the blood lives, we need that blood. We need to find it.
And kind of just through your practice, what have you seen, we'll call it diagnoses, that respond the best to dry needling?
Yeah, so clinically and very anecdotally from my research and from my practice on like my little science experiments that I do with each patient is that I've had pretty good results in plantar fasciopathy. So the ability to get kind of towards where that the plantar fascia originates on the calcaneus has actually been beneficial in terms of helping the patient's pain the morning after. Mm. These patients are definitely sore, and it's my least favorite place to be needled because it feels like a dull toothache. Yeah. But I'd say clinically, I've probably seen a more significant effect there than most of the other places. Additionally, in the shoulder, so like a lot of pitchers and throwers, I've seen a lot of posterior shoulder girdle tightness, and they've all really responded well to dry needling. I can't think of any pitcher who I've needled who's had a detriment or a decrease in function or increase in pain with needling their posterior shoulder girdle. So I think those are probably my two favorite spots to go after in terms of utilizing dry needling clinically.
All right, then the opposite. You've gotten some bad referrals for, hey, can you dry needle this spot? Because it's the last thing I can think of. Do that. What are some things that you've seen that are probably not the best sort of diagnoses to use dry needling for?
Yeah, and I want to state this blankly. Like, I, especially where I work, I do most of the dry needling for the clinic. And so a lot of diagnoses, patients just come in expecting only dry needling.
Yeah.
And what we found in the research is that dry needling alone isn't going to have the big effect, is that when you compare it with exercise, it tends to do better. So most of the time, patients get a little disappointed when I needle them and then make them exercise and make them sweat.
Yeah.
As I said, you have an increase in these central mechanisms, so increased serotonin, increased opioids. So the best thing to do with that is to get the nervous system stimulated with exercise. Most patients hate that. So I guess locations where I tend not to have the best of luck, oh, man, that's a really good question. I'd like to say like the schneck region, like where the shoulder meets the neck.
Yeah.
That area is a little bit more tough, especially because like the levator scapula is a muscle that tends to be overactive in most patients that I see, especially as we sit with desks and sit with poor posture. If you can get that area pretty effectively, you can have an improvement. But some patients have a lot of sensitivity to that area just because of high resting tone. So
yeah.
I'd like to say it's effective, but also it brings a lot of pain to patients when we needle that area.
So if you needle a tonic muscle, mm-hmm. and then they leave and they go right back to their poor postures and driving and keyboard work, is that, you know, just kind of stirs back the pain up and doesn't
exactly.
really settle it issue? Okay.
Yeah, I think there's very short-term improvement with
now,
that.
Now, when
kind
you said you do exercise, do you do it pre or post needling?
Yeah, it's been a little bit of both. Some patients, after you needle them, are very sore and don't want to exercise. Like they are too sore. Sometimes they feel like, oh, my arm feels really heavy. I really would prefer not to move it. So that's where clinically you kind of have to figure out how the patient tolerates pain. And so typically I try to do it towards the end, but then still make them exercise a touch afterwards. But some therapists and colleagues like to utilize it in the beginning. They think, hey, if I can activate the muscle, or in some theories they say they can inhibit the muscle, or sorry, some theories say they can activate the muscle and then have them exercise. They go about it that way as well. Clinically, I've done a little bit of both. I haven't seen a big change one way or the other.
Okay. And you mentioned, you know, the vasodilation and getting blood flow. I mean, exercise in itself is a way to vasodilate and get blood flow as well. So
exactly.
I guess it's depending on the idea or the treatment approach, what you're trying to achieve from the needling.
Exactly, yeah. I think there's something you've said about a little bit of trauma. Like, exercise is traumatic as well. However, sometimes are we really pushing our patients to make enough trauma occur? So if you can actually cause some more local trauma with actual blood through needling these tissues, then it's a possibility that it might have an improved factor as well in what you're doing with your current treatment.
All right. Infograph, dry needling. Let's do it.
Oh, man, that's going to be a really tough one. So if I was to create an infograph on dry needling, I'd likely say that there are improved local physiological responses such as blood flow and muscle relaxation. However, oh, man, I don't know if I can defend an infographic for dry needling right now. That's a tough one, just because there's too many variables we don't know. There's so much out on the table that we don't exactly know what it's used best for. So I think it'd almost just be like a thumbs up, give it a try, see if it works,
Yeah. Knowing
that from an evidence-based practice standpoint, the pillar of research is lacking. So it has to be up to the clinician and up to the patient. If they think, hey, we're at a point where we need something new, then I would utilize dry needling. So almost like I don't want to say a last-ditch effort, but I think that's what my unfortunate infographic for the sales would be. Thankfully not a rep for dry needling at this point.
That's okay, not right now. Yeah. So let's say you're talking to some new referral sources,
mm-hmm.
not totally familiar with dry needling.
Yeah.
And they get, you know, all these different diagnoses. Which ones are you going to tell them are probably not the best fit for dry needling? Because, like, what you don't want is a patient coming in,
yeah.
Oh, my doctor said dry needling is going to fix this.
Exactly.
Right? And then you're having to either explain why it potentially won't, or mm-hmm. you go through a sham treatment. I mean, you don't want to waste a patient's time.
Absolutely.
What kind of diagnoses would you throw into that mix?
Just because of the current literature that we know about chronic pain patients, I'd say anyone with chronic pain likely is not going to benefit from dry needling. This is not a modality that has really shown like that it can stand the test of time in terms of outcomes, because most of the literature has been only done for a short term. So, and the last thing I'd want to do is get like a chronic pain patient hooked on a modality used, because then
sure.
almost as bad as prescription opioids, then we have a problem where this patient requires dry needling. So I definitely would educate them that chronic pain patients likely wouldn't be a patient I'd go to needling first, and it's only a treatment I would probably try for 4 treatment sessions before I would terminate and say, all right, it's had its effect. At this point, it's no longer effective of a treatment. So I'd try to educate the physicians first and foremost on that. I would tell them in an acute muscle setting or like a muscle strain or like the early stages of a tendinopathy, it actually might be more beneficial for. If you can kind of remodel those fibroblasts and the collagen, it actually might help with the scar tissue healing process. So I think that's probably how I would sell it for them.
Okay. Theragun.
Yeah.
So I was watching the Rockets.
Yeah, of course.
And I'm pretty sure I saw Chris Paul getting a little Theragun on the sideline.
I think they actually, like in their locker room, they have like a whole thing of them that are just like hanging Theraguns. So,
is this a new thing? Is this just now coming out? Or, I mean, it's just publicly I've seen it just recently. But, I mean, how long has this been used that you know of in the training room? And
from what I know in the training room, about 4 or 5 years. When I first was a resident here at Memorial Hermann, and I went to – and I did my outreach physical therapy work through the University of Houston, they actually used like a car buffer. That was like initially where they started. So they used like a car buffer to like massage like a person's back or like a football player's thigh. And so I was like, well, that's a little different. Like I hadn't seen a car buffer used before, and then not give it a year later. And then they actually had Theragun and these percussion massage tools. So I say it's been around for a little while. I think the thought of it is new and novel, and that's why it's gaining a lot of popularity and people are utilizing it. Plus, it's in terms of risks or negative consequences, I don't think there really are any.
Yeah.
I don't think you can over percuss a muscle into a fact that you'd be at increased risk for injury or an increased risk of pain. So I think it's probably, of the modalities I discussed, probably the most safe, because I'm not so exactly sure that it does anything clinically or physiologically that would actually result in a problem or a dysfunction. So I think from like, hey, and it's something you can teach athletes to do on themselves. So like cupping, you should probably monitor, but like with this, you can actually have teach the patient how to do it themselves, and then they're good. Think of it like a very expensive foam roll, but more percussive and higher amplitude massage.
So kind of talk about what the percussive input can do for you.
Yeah. So it said that like with the mix between the frequency of 2,000 to 2,500 like revolutions per minute, so how fast that machine goes, also with an amplitude of about 1/2 inch. So the amplitude tries to create the effects of like a deep tissue massage, but the percussion allows it to not be a sustained deep pressure. So the athlete tends to tolerate it better. So say you want to massage an athlete with a deep tissue massage. However, one, you don't have time. Two, the athlete's really sore. This can actually be a nice way to make them less sore, make them tolerate the activity better, and also make them independent in managing their own like muscle pain.
So you mentioned it was shown or helps in reducing pain following exercise.
Yes. So they did eccentric exercise for biceps, and they found that if you utilize a percussion massage tool for 5 minutes beforehand, it can actually have a short-term decrease in post-exercise pain or soreness to that muscle. Physiologically, though, it doesn't demonstrate any changes in the byproducts from exercise. So, like, they still had a lot of lactate dehydrogenase, so a lot of breakdown of muscle tissue. So physiologically, it didn't work, but the patient's perception of pain was lower. So that's a win in my book. Athletes are feeling less sore and feeling like they're able to go, especially when you have athletes who sometimes compete in all-day tournaments. Think of like a weekend warrior who's got volleyball games scheduled all day on Saturday. Hey, go ahead and use the Theragun. It might actually help with your muscle soreness.
You mentioned increase in blood flow.
Yes, that's what they theorize. Yeah. I think they're just taking some anecdotal evidence from massage that, hey, if you rub something, there's more blood flow.
Yeah.
I think that's where they took it from.
So like erythema on the skin, and that's pretty much it?
Yeah, I think when you think about the amplitude that it has of 1/2 inch, that's what, 12 millimeters. So theoretically, based off the anatomy, you could have an increase in like local like microcirculation. They haven't done any studies that actually have looked into if there is an actual increase in the blood flow. So at least immediately after the use. So I'm not quite sure if the blood flow really stands the physiology test.
Any benefit of doing this over manual hands-on?
Yeah, that's That's a good question, right? We know that like when you touch a patient, they tend to like it more. Right. So I think in that placebo effect and that contact and that relationship is an important part of treating patients, especially in pain. So I don't necessarily know. They did a comparison in that study that I had mentioned where they did look at massage and when they did look at utilizing the percussion tool, and there wasn't really any statistical difference between those two in terms of blood flow, in terms of the lactate dehydrogenase, and in terms of pain. So it has a similar effect to it. So seemingly it should be around the same thing.
All right. And these are pretty much widespread amongst schools,
seemingly, yeah.
Trainers should have access to
them. I mean, at $600 a pop and you can just order it from the website, it doesn't seem like it'd be that hard to get. It's okay. Not like you need a certification to use it. It seems like they can make as many of these devices and make as many patents as they want and create a little market for themselves. So seemingly it can go on for a while.
Any known contraindications?
No, not at this time.
Okay. Like, let's say, like a...
Besides any general contraindications to massage, then there are no other,
right. So, freshly, torn muscle, you don't want to go in there and start beating it
exactly
up.
Exactly, yeah. Or a fracture might be a bad idea to use a percussion tool on it.
All right, let's move on to BFR.
Yes, this is the exciting one.
Yeah, so this is the one that's really popular. You know, obviously, in the Houston area, we had one of our big athletes kind of come through with it. A lot of the clinics with Memorial Hermann are starting to get some of them that are associated with Dr. Lowe and all of his physicians. So kind of give me a breakdown of what you talked with BFR and then the use that you have in the clinics that you work at.
Yeah, so the premise behind blood flow restriction training is that you're following the same physiology as exercise, but you're removing a little bit of the oxygen. So what they found is that when you exercise with low load intensity, like low load resistance training with a tourniquet, you can have similar effects in muscle strength and hypertrophy compared to using high level or high load intensity workouts resistance training. So that's very exciting, particularly considering when you're actually having a patient exercise who's early postoperative. If you have them lift really heavy, they're likely going to have a lot of pain, or you can have graft site complications, such as with an ACL and patellar tendon pain. So if you can actually have the patient exercise at lower intensity, but still get improvements in muscle strength and hypertrophy, that's a win for everyone involved. So it's been utilized a lot in our clinic, and then we have several research studies based around it, trying to establish the right patients that it can be utilized for, and then also how to progress these patients in terms of short-term and long-term outcomes. So we're still collecting data at this time, and then still haven't had a chance to analyze the data. So it'll be interesting to see how it actually has been effective in our specific clinic. But from a global standpoint, the research has been probably the most favorable, and it's probably been the most exciting than any of the other kind of new modalities out there.
So somebody who's just kind of hearing about it or who has heard about it and needs to look into it, kind of talk about where would be some good resources for them to go look into.
Yeah, absolutely. So I have to reference this one, and I'm not endorsed by this at all, but we brought in Johnny Owens of the Owens Recovery Science. So he is one of the frontier investigators for blood flow restriction use in the United States. He initially started utilizing it in San Antonio when he worked with a lot of traumatic post-limb salvage procedures for veterans. So they'd come back from the war and they'd have traumatic surgeries for sparing the limb, and he would need to find a way to keep this muscle fast, because unfortunately what he was finding is that these athletes would see their friends and fellow veterans actually lose a limb and do better than they were rehabbing when they had a limb, because they had such a disparity in their tissue healing. So Johnny had to come up with a way to actually make these veterans feel like they were actually having an improvement in their strength and in their muscle size. And so this is what he looked into the research in Japan and then brought it over. From there, he went to several different organizations, so professional sports teams, college sport teams, and he came to different clinics and educated us on its use. So he pulled a large amount of the Ironman staff and educated us on how it can actually be utilized. And that's kind of where I first had heard about it and had seen it actually put to use and feeling it and undergoing actually what it feels like, feeling like, wow, I'm lifting a lot of weight, but I'm really only doing a bicep curl of 3 pounds. Like, that's pretty demeaning physically. Sure, right. It feels like emotionally, like, wow, I should be able to lift more than this. But understanding the science behind the power of restricting blood flow and the power of building up lactate and having your fast twitch muscles really fire at very low intensity exercises is pretty exciting. And not to get sore 2 days later after seemingly trying to get your muscles exhausted is pretty exciting.
So this is obviously a big a big benefit for those who cannot lift heavy, like you mentioned, due to surgery, graft, or injury, tendinopathy. Kind of give me some populations that this has really kind of been proven to be helpful for.
Yeah, most commonly we utilize it in a lot of our post-operative patients who have had ACL, because that's where we primarily try and reserve the machine for. It's been used really for any diagnosis out there. So patients with low back pain, even though you're placing the tourniquet only around like the proximal thigh, it still has an improvement in multifidus size and multifidus recruitment, which is pretty exciting. So even though the cuff is distal to the muscle that you're working, even say the glute, you can still get proximal gains in muscle size and muscle recruitment. So that's pretty exciting. So it doesn't really leave a diagnosis out of the mix. From a contraindication standpoint, though, what they've theorized is try not to use it with like extensive hand operations. So people that have had extensive hand work or trigger and pulley work, any sort of small distal hand tendon repair, they've also tried to stay away from. I think that's just because of possible the intensity of the exercise and getting the dose correct. As I said earlier, these patients are working at a very low intensity, typically like a 2 to 3 out of 10 on an RPE scale, 0 being no work, 10 being the most work they can do. I think they were potentially concerned about how the patients with like significant edema or significant hand reconstructions would do.
So if you're post-op and you have swelling, is there any reason to be concerned if you're using blood flow restriction?
Yeah, so what they found is that there actually is no increased problem with utilizing blood flow restriction in terms specifically of like a thrombus formation. Mm-hmm. What they've actually found is counterintuitive to that. So when utilizing this restriction through a tourniquet, it actually helps decrease the risk of thrombus formation. So it's actually more or less helping you not get a blood clot, right, which is pretty exciting.
Yeah, well, and, you know, one of the big factors that doctors kind of go above and beyond to make sure it doesn't happen post-op, this is something else that can potentially help in that.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely.
So earliest application, you said ACLs like post-op. So are you, what's the earliest application you'd start using it post-op week? And then also just kind of what are you looking for in the patient to know that they're ready for it?
Yeah, so as a standard of care for our clinic specifically, and a lot of the research protocols that we're following, just for the research that we're performing, we aren't using it until 2 weeks out of surgery. That's typically due to wanting to ensure that the graft site, particularly for like the knees and the scar, is actually fine and that there's no abnormalities in scar healing. So then once the 2 weeks is out, then we typically start applying the tourniquet. I'm not a part of the research, so I tend to use it a little bit sooner on my patients, particularly like with their quad sets for the post-op ACLs. If it's for a rotator cuff, then I still can have it the earliest that I get them in there, which is typically 3 to 4 weeks after rotator cuff surgery already. So they're out of that immediate scar tissue healing phase. So seemingly you can utilize it as early as you want, but just per our clinic standards with the research that we're performing, we leave it to around 2 weeks after surgery.
And so, you know, luckily having one of these devices at my clinic, I've kind of put in some research myself just because I want to know the best way to utilize it. And coming across all different kinds of studies, there's different protocols. Mm-hmm. There's different times of usage. They're using it with NMES, without NMES, kind of coming up with ways to do that. One of my questions personally is, if a person doesn't have activation of a muscle, right? What's the benefit? What's the cost of them? You're giving them this discomfort, which is potentially beneficial to the muscle, right? But they have pretty poor activation of the muscle. How high of a ceiling do they have? Doing it at that point, should it be better utilized later when they can actually get a good activation? Or is it something that you should just say, hey, this thing is going to help out regardless? What have you shown?
Yeah, absolutely. I really don't think I've seen a huge problem with it in those that have a muscle recruitment problem versus those that have a strength problem. I think it's something I probably should pay more attention to clinically. Just say, hey, if I have a person whose quad is only recruiting at 20% of their other side compared to like utilizing a superficial biofeedback device, I haven't really seen any changes in terms of them benefiting from it versus someone who doesn't have a recruitment problem, someone who's recruiting at 80% of their other side in terms of biofeedback. So I think that's something I should probably pay more attention to before I actually say anything about that. Have you seen anything?
It's one of the questions. You know, we've had it for about 3 months now, and so our post-op knees, we start to use it. I like to see – so my kind of – what I like to do is I like to see superior patellar glide.
Yeah.
So it shows that quad is activating, it's shortening, it's going through the cycle. I know it's doing something, right? And at that point, I feel like, if I want to add – to that, I know the quad at least is going to go through some type of contraction.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Yeah, I think that's probably a really good criterion to say, hey, I need to at least know that the quad is activating and getting a superior glide of the patella before I would put it on there. Yeah. I don't have a such strict criterion just because, in theory, if I can just trap lactate in there, that muscle is going to signal to recruit its type 2 muscle fibers. So from a recruitment standpoint, from a neural standpoint, I'm going to put it on there. But knowing that if there's like a, say it's like a cervical radiculopathy patient, say it's someone who actually has like neural weakness, that's where we actually see it not benefit at all. So that's important to know.
Yeah, the research is showing just laying there, you're getting some type of benefit with it on there for the lower quarter.
Yeah, for cell swelling, right? Because when you put the blood flow on and you just even have the patient sit there, the cell is actually bathed in water. So it actually starts to swell, and that reinforces cell structure, which can effectively make the muscle bigger and stronger.
Yeah. So the muscle research hypertrophy mechanisms, Brad Schoenfeld does a lot of that, some guy I read. The metabolic disturbance is one of those factors, and I think the blood flow goes right into that with that, the lactate, the basically just kind of disturbing the homeostasis of the muscle and all those things that the
mTORC1, the TGF,
all those fancy
the
words,
growth
yeah.
hormone, yeah, yeah, all yeah. the growth factor, all of those things that help muscle fibrosis.
The pump and the
hypertrophy.
Burn, man.
Yeah, it's the, yeah. the pump is real.
Yeah. real quick, hierarchy of muscle exercises. Do you have any particular exercises you feel like work best?
Yeah. So, and it really comes down to specificity of the muscle. So if it's quad, I found longer quad tends to be the best because that's the only muscle working in isolation.
Yeah,
so agreed. Single joint muscles tend to do better, but you still get a pretty big effect from you doing like a squat. So a multi-joint or multi-angle exercise. So, and with that, you can potentially target more muscles. And it's thought that particularly for like, say, if you wanted to strengthen up the rotator cuff or let's say like the posterior delt for whatever reason. So even though the cuff is placed distal to that muscle, you actually get like fatigue of the muscles that are synergistic with that distally. And then that's what's thought to help the proximal muscle gains. So say for a bench press, when you're actually doing a bench press, your triceps tend to get more fatigued. And then that results in more higher EMG of the pec, which actually results in the pec getting bigger. Yeah. So seemingly a lot of muscles in a lot of different theories, proximal or distal, can have an effect with it.
Well, we can go on for longer, but obviously we have more questions. So if somebody does have some questions for you, Kevin, how can they reach you?
Yeah, go ahead and contact me at my email. It's kevin.maloney, that's M-A-L-O-N-E-Y, at memorialherman.org.
All right, so this was a sports medicine broadcast. You can find us at the sportsmedicinebroadcast.com, and then you can find Kevin's talk at sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/presenter Maloney 2018. Appreciate it, sir.
Absolutely. Thank you.
All right, take care.